The Last Command, part of the Starman series, www.starmanseries.com. Copyright 2005 by David Bauman, John Cooper, and Mike Dodd. Chapter 2, The Eve of War. Later that same day, Alan and Elizabeth Foster sat in their customary viewing chairs in the alcove before the great bay window in their home on the outskirts of Edmondson City. Their son David and his guest George St. George sat in two other chairs. Alan was at one end, next to his wife, and David was at the other end with George, next to Elizabeth, and closest to the refreshments. A large pot of tea rested on an octagonal table within easy reach of everyone, next to a sugar bowl. A plate of oatmeal cookies and another of dried apricots crowded out the last space on the table. Through the window, the watchers could see across the dusky plateau and beyond the horizon into the blackness of space. The sun, hovering on the edge of sight just to the right of center, cast long black shadows wherever a boulder or slight elevation relieved the level desolation. Several moon vehicles crawled like caterpillars across the gray plain, following well-worn avenues to supply points and research stations beyond the wall of Shackleton Center. "Delicious, Elizabeth," stated George, with a solemn nod of his shaggy head. "Too good for a wastrel like me. I'm afraid that the cooking I've provided for myself and my crew for the past 24 years has made my innards unfit for the cuisine they have enjoyed at your table today." Alan covered an involuntary snicker with a discreet cough. With a quick glance of disapproval in her husband's direction, Elizabeth said, "Nonsense, George. David has told me that you're a skilled chef." "Alas, Mrs. Foster, I am afraid that the first time I cooked for him back on the SC Supply asteroid 0344, he and his friends were so exflunked and famished that dog food would have seemed like a banquet fit for a king." There wasn't much that could be said after that, so David's mother filled their guest's teacup with a demure smile and pointed him to the plates of after-dinner treats. David had never much liked the traditional cake and ice cream for his birthday, but he loved oatmeal cookies. "When will your treatment be finished, Dad?" asked David, a question intended to change the subject since he already knew the answer. Alan, knowing that was his son's reason for asking, hastened to respond. 11 days, he stated firmly. "Then I'll be fit for space duty again, and just in time, too." Elizabeth's face suddenly registered tension and anxiety. "In time to go to war, Alan," she said in a tone of voice that sounded almost like an accusation. "I'd rather you were still grounded. You know how I've chafed for 30 years. 30 years, Elizabeth! No spaceman should be grounded for so long. No spaceman should..." The old starman paused. "I'm sorry," he said quietly at last. "I can understand how you feel. I just wish you could understand a bit more what it's been like for me." George St. George did not appear to be uncomfortable at all with the unanticipated eruption of a family squabble. "Perhaps the new technology that has made it possible to restore your husband's damaged tissues has come at the right time, Elizabeth," he said. "No right-thinking person ever desires war, but if we're forced into it to defend our lives and our homes and our culture, then we want the best people we've got to do that defending. And there are none better than Alan Foster." "A bit of an exaggeration, St. George," said Alan, obviously gratified, "but I thank you for your words." "What's happening in the belt now?" asked David, his eyes staring out the window. "A great many people are leaving," said St. George with sudden soberness. "They've been leaving for more than 2 years, but the pace of the exodus picked up about 6 months ago. Settlements are down by about a third of their customary population, and the miners seem to be disappearing too. At least business at the supply posts and the social centers has diminished by about the same amount. Word is that a lot of people expect that the Xenobots are going to begin an invasion in the Belt, which is where they always seem to appear first whenever they come into the interplanetary system. How is Montezuma Vlai, George? Asked the younger Starman. I didn't get an answer when I asked that question earlier. He's still in the Belt, hanging on to his home. He's got a lot of confidence in the Starmen. He says that if anyone can succeed against the Xenobots, you will, and if you fail, it doesn't really matter where he'll be when the enemy comes into the solar system. So he says that he might as well stay where he is. He isn't going to leave. He doesn't have a very high opinion of the crowd that's fleeing. Sounds reasonable, said Alan. We've got our hypershields up, and our warships are increasing in number every day. The Imanians are moving faster than we ever thought possible. Any enemy'd have to be beyond foolish to launch an attack anywhere in our solar system right now. It's the Xenobots who have reason to worry, not us. I agree with you, Dad, began David, that the Belt is under no greater risk than anywhere else in the inner system. But I have an uneasy feeling that we and our allies are becoming overconfident. The Xenobots, confident, yes, David's father interrupted, but overconfident, I don't think so. We're being careful. Our best strategists and analysts are working with all the information we've got or can guess. Why, I've never seen the people of Earth labor so effectively or with such cooperation, and having the Imanians working with us just adds to our strength. Our probes have located every Xenobot-held star system in Omega Centauri, and they haven't won any battles against us since you came back from there more than 2 years ago. David looked over at his mother and saw the anxiety written across her features and decided to let the conversation drop at that point. But to himself he said, "It's not going to be that easy." He looked back out to the spartanly beautiful terrain. The scene was fixed in his memory, for except for the road created by the passage of many vehicles, it hadn't changed from before his memories began. He nibbled on one of the oatmeal cookies and took a sip of tea. The cookies were good, as always. Oatmeal cookies, no matter where he ate them, invariably made him think of his home, but the ones his mother made were always his favorite. His gaze wandered around inside of the viewing room, and he took note of the way the chairs were placed, how his parents sat close together. The gray carpet appeared almost as if he were seeing it for the first time. He observed its texture and the subtle design worked into its threads. Had it always been that way? Of course it had. He had grown up with this carpet. His eyes traced the graceful curves of the legs of the small table that held the teapot and refreshments. How lovely it was! He smiled slightly. And then he quickly sobered. The war with the Xenobots would be launched very soon. It was quite possible that this carpet, this table, this house, the entire city could be turned into disconnected atoms by summer's end. "What are you thinking, David?" asked his mother, breaking a long silence. "I was just thinking how I like this house," he replied. His mother smiled broadly and sat back content. Robert Nolan flew his personal spacecraft, the Nova, over the extensive orchards in the northern hemisphere of Emania. Even at an altitude of 5 miles, the spread of fruit trees ran to the horizon in every direction. Nolan laughed with earnest satisfaction. "This is wonderful, wonderful, Kateri." His assistant, the Mohawk woman, Kateri Tegathwitha, also smiled broadly. Her long black hair was pulled back in 3 strands after the fashion of Imanian women, but braided after the tradition of her own people. A choker of wrought silver was wrapped delicately around her throat and featured a yellow topaz in the front that beautifully set off her clear copper skin. Her smile revealed even milk-white teeth. "You are well named, Kateri," said Robert. The woman's last name meant, "She who puts all things in order." "You have said that many times, Robert," she said, but still pleased with the compliment. "Because it is true. If it were not for your assistance, Emania would not have come as far as it has in so short a time. Nolan Management and Distribution Company is, words failed him, is responsible for the rebuilding of Emania," Kateri completed the sentence. Nolan laughed. "I wouldn't go that far," he said, "but please just the same. Landing the contract to assist the Emanians made it possible for us to build a new company. This is far more satisfying than the old Nolan Mining Enterprise. I hardly remember those days now, but our best staff from those days now make NMDC better than ever. While Richard and Starlight Enterprise have been doing research and building spacecraft for battle by the hundreds, we've been helping to rebuild a planet. We're partners now in a better way than at any time in the past." "We're almost at the Animal Breeding Center, Robert," said Kateri. Nolan confidently brought the Nova into a landing on a field inside a large complex of buildings and open ground, located several miles beyond the far edge of the orchard. The terrain in which it was situated resembled an African veldt. The complex itself included large fenced-in areas in which a number of animals roamed. Buildings the size of spacecraft hangars were arranged like the spokes of an immense wheel. The landing field was located in the center. One building, nearly twice the size of the others, was the headquarters for the project. Robert Nolan and Kateri debarked from their ship and greeted the half-dozen Emanians who had hastened to meet them. "The animal breeding programs are proceeding on schedule, Mr. Nolan," said one of the Emanians in response to a question Robert had asked. "We can count on as much success as the seeding programs to the west." "Really," responded Nolan with his eyebrows raised, "I am surprised. The old crop dusters out there are turning the desert into fertile fields faster than we had hoped. One good rainy season to help the irrigation, and we'll be able to feed another 2 million by next year at this time. Our small animal departments will be able to provide the worms, beetles, and all the insects they'll need on schedule, sir." "You hear that, Kateri? Why, the project is picking up speed." "Yes, Robert, there is still an entire planet to be transformed, but we've made a start." "A start? That's an understatement. In 2 or 3 years, Emania will be able to support its entire population of sleepers." As the party approached the main entrance to the headquarters, the distant sound of children laughing and playing came to their ears. In the midst of the happy sounds, there was a loud crack followed by shouts. "What was that?" asked Nolan. "Sounds as if someone got a hit," said the Emanian. "A hit? Maybe a home run, judging from the shouts." "Baseball?" exclaimed Nolan incredulously. "We are importing more than seeds and animals, Mr. Nolan," said the Emanian with a smile, opening the door to the headquarters. Over the doorway were a few words written in flowing Emanian letters. Below, in English, were the words, "Recovering the First Treasure, Headquarters." 2 hours precisely until launch, the voice of King Ismaka of Emania was measured and confident. "Yes, sir," responded Plera, commander of Tharsos, "we are ready." It was 3 weeks after David Foster's birthday. The central command of the Earth-Emanian Alliance was gathered on the bridge of Tharsos, the premier Emanian warship. Technicians were at their posts checking figures and confirming the location of more than 10,000 robotic battle probes poised for a simultaneous command to invade Xenobot space. The asteroid-turned-Emanian flagship was inside the asteroid belt and sheathed against any normal or extraordinary means of search. In other places throughout the interplanetary system, nearly 35,000 warships of both Earth and Amania were on alert and ready for orders. On the bridge of Tharsis, Commander John Lewis of Space Command was in close conversation with Kerex, the guardian of the bustling Amanian military city of Olivanda inside the great asteroid. Nearly a dozen starmen were to be in place for the launching of the battle probes, including Mark Seaton and Joe Taylor. All had arrived but two who were expected at any moment. All at once, the main access door to the bridge opened, and two famous starmen entered, David Zip Foster and his father, Alan. When the elder Foster crossed the portal and entered the bridge, spontaneous applause broke out, and everyone present rose to greet him. Starman Foster's broad smile and jaunty salute expressed everything he needed to say. The applause did not die down for nearly a minute. Zip quietly and unobtrusively made his way to where Mark and Joe were standing, where they greeted him with a couple of slaps on the shoulder. Alan strode over to where Ismaka, Kerex, Commander Lewis, and Pleera were assembled. "Starman Alan Foster reporting for duty, sirs," he said dashingly as he bowed slightly to each one in turn. "And miss," he added when he bowed to Pleera. "Welcome to Tharsis, Starman," said Ismaka, and shook his hand warmly in a double grip. "We are pleased that you have been healed and are now released for space travel once again." After further congratulations, the three men excused themselves and strolled away to inspect the preparations for the coming launch. Pleera stayed with the older Starman. "It is a privilege to meet you, Starman Foster," said Pleera, obviously thrilled with the encounter. "I am pleased to meet the first Earthman to make contact with extraterrestrial life in the solar system, and honored to be a commander of the ship that is your first posting since that venture." She was referring to the ill-fated deep space expedition of 2130 that Alan had commanded, during which initial contact was made with the denizens of Titan. "Welcome back to space," she concluded warmly. "Thank you, Pleera. It is a pleasure for me to meet you in person. My son has told me a lot about you. I am grateful to you for saving his life." "Many people are responsible for the success of that expedition, Starman Foster, and on their behalf, as well as myself, I receive your thanks. However," here Pleera dropped the formal speech, turned her head slightly to one side, and smiled disarmingly, "the Titanian Jack was most responsible of all. Perhaps one can trace your son's survival directly back to your own actions 30 years ago. Alan smiled and then turned his gaze around the bridge, taking in the controls, monitors, indicators, and especially the operations tank in the center of the great room. I have to admit, I'm somewhat daunted by the technology of the spacecraft, Pleera. Even the starlight shuttlecraft that brought David and me here was something new to me." He lowered his voice. "I'm afraid that I won't have much to contribute to the effort." "Starman Foster," she began. "Please call me Alan," he interrupted. "Very well, Alan," she said. "Don't underestimate yourself. The anticipation of your arrival gave enormous encouragement to us here. We know that you do not have current training, but that can and will be overcome. Your presence has already boosted morale. Even before you stepped through that portal, you contributed to the success of this mission." "Thank you. If you're not otherwise occupied, would you mind explaining to me what is about to happen? My son has described it to me, but I'd like to hear your account as well." "Of course. I shouldn't be needed for at least another hour. You may recall that examination of the Xenobot ship that Starman Joe Taylor landed on Mars nearly 4 years ago revealed that the Xenobot's solar power stations are connected to their spacecraft and selected bases by antimatter feeds. We discovered that their fighting ships maintain a steady link to a solar power station over a tachyon band. When necessary, its internal power center draws more fuel from the power station. During the process, a very thin wormhole connection is established between the fighter and its power station. A stream of antimatter is sent over this connection and acts as fuel for the craft. The power is virtually without limit. During the past 2 years and more since we decimated the invading Xenobot fleet, we've searched out all Xenobot presence in the central Omega Centauri region encased by the shell of our hypershield, both by robotic probe and manned ships. Our probes were designed by Starlight Enterprise to search for and detect any unusual activity in space that involved antimatter, as well as the artificial bending of space that indicated wormhole travel. As you probably know, that is a telltale signature of a functioning solar power station. An immense undertaking, said Alan, impressed. In fact, I can hardly believe that it was possible to search an entire star cluster in the time you had. The probes were seeded by an ingenious algorithm designed by your Stephen Hoshino and many assistants working with supercomputers. The launch of a master probe would, by prearranged time delay, make possible for the launching of two others contained inside it. These, after another measured delay, would launch two others, up to a total of 63 probes in each unit. With wormhole travel and tachyon communication, the entire star cluster was searched in a little less than a year. With the increase in technological ability made possible by the continuing research into the secrets of the Lucian crystals, Dr. Hoshino was able to design this system along lines similar to the microwave net he used athwart Lurton's Zimbardo back in 2151. The probes were sheathed and non-invasive in the hope that the Xenobots would not be able to detect them. However, even if they were detected, they would still function. The entire operation was put together by Dr. Hoshino, asked Alan, astonished, in just 2 years? No, Alan, replied the Amanian with a slight shake of her head. That would be a miracle indeed. Remember that Amania fought the Xenobots and won 12 millennia ago. Not only were many of our original warships preserved in Olivanda, but our data-gathering network from that age is still in place. It covered nearly a third of the galaxy. The Xenobots, as they recovered, managed to locate and destroy every piece of Amanian apparatus within their own star cluster. But 92.4% of the system outside Omega Centauri is still functional. We were able to reactivate that much of the network, and it is now operational. With our help, Dr. Hoshino and his team were able to modify and improve the former system, and then tie it in to make it productive for our current needs. I see, said Alan, nodding his head energetically. As a result of the probes, Plera continued, a vast map was created that showed the distribution of all Xenobot activity that used antimatter and wormhole transfer. Although our own probes could pass through it, the enemy has not permeated the great wormhole shield that we imposed around the core of their star cluster. In the past 2 years, further data gathered from Lucian crystals has made it possible for us to redefine the shield into an impressive lattice capable not only of preventing travel by wormholes, but also all attempts to cross it by sublight speeds. An immediate defensive flare is created by any unauthorized passage that is strong enough to destroy the greatest ship that the Xenobots can boast. Yet your own ships can pass through it? Yes, and even achieve wormhole travel. The shield is in constant flux, flickering up to 500,000,000,000 times each second. Based on the principle of the RRFC system, the Rapid Random Frequency Change system, used in compads, our own ships can be attuned to the sensors in the hyperlattice and pass through the barrier unscathed. Any attempt by the Xenobots to cross this barrier by wormhole, sublight velocity, or even by real-time transmission from within or without have been noted, measured, and charted. Every attempt made from outside to enter the central portion of Omega Centauri has been traced so that we are able to determine its source. We trust that that method, coupled with our restored network, made it possible for us to locate sites in the galaxy where there is a Xenobot presence. There were fewer than 100 of these, and they are now included in our present plans. Then you are confident that you have located all the Xenobots in the galaxy? Alan looked a little dubious. We are hopeful that is the case, responded Pleera cautiously. If there are any Xenobots who did not attempt to control their home base by tachyon or wormhole communications, then their whereabouts are still unknown to us. It is not possible to search the entire galaxy. So even if our current strategy is successful, we plan to maintain our guard for generations to come. What is the current strategy? Rather simple at this point. Over the past year, Earth and Emania have deployed robotic attack drones, a single hyperspatial jump away from every site in the galaxy we've located that is controlled by the Xenobots. These attack drones have one purpose. They are designed to enter the Xenobot-held star system and disrupt the tachyon waves the enemy is using in such a way that their solar power stations and anything connected to them will become unstable and explode. The time to launch these drones is now. Pleera took a quick glance at the shipboard clock. Just over an hour away. Theoretically, then, all the Xenobots can be destroyed with this attack. Theoretically, Alan, said Pleera with another disarming smile. But we do not expect so. We believe that we are able to pierce the Xenobot shields thanks to further research done on the Lucian crystals that Joe provided. Xenobot technology has not changed in centuries, and we expect to have no trouble launching a surprise attack and invading their power systems. But we also think it likely that their central headquarters will be powerfully defended, better than any outlying base. The Xenobot central defenses have not ever been tested, not since the war over 12,000 years ago. We Amanians overwhelmed them then. Indeed, King Ismaga, then our prince, led the attack as he is leading this one. Since that time, however, the enemy has had a long time to regroup. We know that the Xenobots have been in decline for many centuries, perhaps a millennium. But we can only guess at what stage their technological growth peaked. On that we have no information at all. After a brief pause, Alan said, If this action is successful, then the Xenobot power station will be destroyed and the vast majority of the enemy fleet will become dust and radiation. Yes, affirmed Pleera with a quick nod of her head. The remaining Xenobot presence, in whatever state it is after our attack, will have to be dealt with. There are several plans for the course we must take, but first we must know how successful our attack is. Commander, said a technician who'd approached the place where the Amanian and the Starman were conversing, forgive my interrupting you. The king asks that you join him for the final countdown. Thank you, said Pleera. I'll come at once. She favored Alan with a confident smile and then turned away. After the Amanian commander left him, Alan looked around the bridge and saw many people at their tasks. For a moment he felt useless. Then he saw his son and his friends staring into the operations tank and began to stroll over toward them. 45 minutes, came an announcement. Time passed. On the word, a real-time signal was sent to the robotic fleet of drones to commence the invasion. Within minutes, they had leaped across hyperspace and entered all known Xenobot territory. Now the leaders of the Alliance simply had to wait to learn what would happen.